Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Today is July 25. It's Thursday. It's the day that we always speak about the Middle East, and it'll be the same today. So what's interesting is that this is Westchester on the Level. My name is Hezi Harris. We're going to deal with all the concerns regarding the Middle East. A lot of stuff is happening. And it always seems to be, I don't know, there's a lot of drama, but there's also a lot of bloodshed. And so I guess one would say we really need to pay attention to everything that goes on and on. And otherwise, it's just very hard otherwise if we don't keep in touch with what's happening. So let's start off with some of the unbelievable news that's come about. I guess the first thing is that after a three-year deadlock, there is evidently going to be some sort of movement forward. At least that's the promise. Israelis and Palestinians are going to resume peace talks in Washington this coming Tuesday. That'll be very interesting. It's also the day that will be a unique day for us because in case news should be coming out, that particular day, we may be able to hear what's going on as it's happening. Richard Narog, co-host of the show, is not going to be on that particular day. So you never know. These things might just work out because they work out. Now, in case you want to join us in conversation, you're welcome to do so. Phone number here is 347-205-9201. Again, 347-205-9201. And so this is Westchester on the Level, and the situation with the peace talks promised on Tuesday is that Israeli officials are confirming that the talks are expected to last about 9 months and to open with discussions of Palestinian borders and Israel's security demands. So negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians will definitely resume on Tuesday in Washington. Energy and Water Resources Minister Silvan Shalom told reporters in Jericho on Thursday. Shalom has been meeting in Jericho with Saeb Erekat, the head of the Palestinian negotiating team, to discuss the possibility of renewing peace talks which broke down in late 2010. He made the announcement at a press conference on Thursday following the dedication of a joint industrial zone in Jericho that was initiated and funded by the Japanese government. Now, the industrial zone will be operated by Palestinians and its products sold to Jordan. Also participating in the event were the Jordanian Interior Minister, the Palestinian Planning Minister, and the Japanese Foreign Minister. A senior Israeli official confirmed Shalom's announcement. The official said the decision to renew peace talks on Tuesday was made by U.S. officials and senior Israeli and Palestinian officials during a series of telephone calls. Justice Minister, the Israeli Justice Minister, Tzipi Livni, who is responsible for the Israeli government's negotiations with the Palestinians, is expected to participate in the Washington meeting. Also expected to participate is the Prime Minister's personal envoy, Isaac Molho. Now, Erekat, the Palestinian, will be participating on behalf of the Palestinians, and the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will represent the United States. Kerry announced the resumption of talks last week after a series of meetings with each of the sides. Now, according to senior officials in Jerusalem, the meeting in Washington is expected to deal primarily with the agenda for holding negotiations, including the subjects to be discussed and the timetable. The talks are expected to last about 9 months and to open with discussions on both the borders of the Palestinian state and Israel's security demands. In advance of the meeting, the Israeli cabinet is expected this coming Sunday to approve the release of 82 Palestinian prisoners who were involved in attacks against Israel and also have been in prison since the pre-Oslo Accords period. So the prisoners are expected to be released in four rounds over 8 to 9 months. At the same cabinet meeting, the ministers are also expected to approve a bill that would require a national referendum over any peace agreement with the Palestinians. So that's the situation that comes out of Israel. And so we'll see what else is happening. We may return to just to hear what's going on over there. Now, so the next move for us will be to move over to the France 24, where they mention the assassination of the Tunisian opposition leader and the leader of Tunisia's opposition party, Mohamed Brahmi, was shot dead Thursday morning, a political source and local radio reported. And Brahmi held a seat in the assembly and was charged with writing the new constitution. So the opposition leader, Mohamed Brahmi, who belonged to the nationalist and secular popular party, was shot dead outside his home, outside his house in the capital of Tunis on Thursday, a member of his party had said. Brahmi was a vocal critic of the Islamist-led government and a member of the Constituent Assembly charged with drawing up the North African country's new constitution. He was shot in front of his house when he was with his disabled daughter. Mohamed Napki, a member of the same party, told Reuters the killers fled on a motorbike. The February assassination of another secular politician, Chokri Belaid, ignited the worst violence in Tunisia since the 2011 fall of the autocratic president Zine Al Abidine Ben Ali. And wow, just unbelievable. Let's hear what the report is, and just listening to the report, the news report from Agence France-Presse. Bear with me a moment, it'll unfold. Bear with me any second now.
The important thing we know about him is that we say, yeah, he was a member of the opposition. He was a virulent critic, that is the only way to term it, of the dominant party right now, Tunisia, Ennahda, which is the Islamist party, which is the head of a sort of three-party coalition. It governs with two center-left parties and not a very much in the Islamist mold. He's been extremely critical of Ennahda, and in fact actually encouraged the Tunisian equivalent of Tamarad. You remember Tamarad? That was the movement, the resistance movement that overthrew Mohamed Morsi. Equivalent of it in Tunisia, and he was actually very much almost encouraging Tamarad to go after Ennahda in Tunisia. So he was no friend of the governing Islamists. He was also on the committee, the National Constituent Assembly, a member of that assembly, which is writing Tunisia's new constitution, so obviously playing a role. He had earlier been the leader of a leftist movement called actually the People's Movement, the National People's Movement. He was general secretary of that. He left that movement actually shortly after Chokri Belaid, who you just mentioned, was killed. And he joined his movement, which is called the Popular Front. They're similar, but not exactly the same. But they both have one thing in common. They're very sort of Arab-based nationalist movements, not always in line with what with some of the government policy coming out of the governing coalition.
Now, Tunisia is, of course, the birthplace of the Arab Spring. And this is the second such political assassination we've seen just this year.
It is, and I'll also mention the fact that the man who was just assassinated, Mohamed Brahmi, he was from Sidi Bouzid, which is the birthplace of the Arab Spring. It's where the Bender actually was confronted by the police, which sparked everything. This is the second time this year. You're absolutely right, and you could say it sets a very dangerous precedent because already Ennahda had been under a lot of criticism, by definition, from its critics, that it was failing to secure control of the country, and that it was failing to sort of face off and get tough with the more hardline Islamists, the even more radical ones, the Salafists. Now, no one knows who's behind this assassination. We have to be very clear about that. There are no names. I'm not even going to try to speculate right now. Last time around, they tried to blame it on the hardline Salafists. They still don't know for sure who was behind that attack. One thing is for sure. The last assassination, they were able to spark a political crisis. They were able, after lots and lots of arguments and puffing, they were able to sort things out with a new prime minister and a new reshuffled government. My guess is that, and not just my guess, but a lot of people who were observing this early on, the initial hunch is that it's not going to be so easy this time around to just put the pieces back together again. Each of these assassinations tends to build on itself, and it becomes almost sort of meteorically harder to put back together.
That was the report from Agence France-Presse. Very, very frightening situation. Okay, well, that's the crisis there. Very, very pertinent one. And as was mentioned in the report, each situation ends up building upon itself while the actual ability to put things together dissipates. A very frightening, sense of what's going on. Okay, so that's the situation there. Let's go on to what's going on in the rest of the world. It seems that, let me just quickly look here. There was a special notice that you may have just heard in the background a moment ago, and that is that the United Nations has now recognized that over 100,000 people have died in the crisis of Syria. So we'll get to that in just a little bit. But that was the latest news that just came out. Another thing that's really quite interesting, even though it has nothing to do with the Middle East, but certainly has unbelievable ramifications, is that the U.S. House, the Congress, has voted to continue NSA's phone surveillance. And the House of Representatives has narrowly voted to continue collecting data on U.S. phone calls in the first legislative move on the program. And in a 205-217 vote, lawmakers rejected an effort to restrict the National Security Agency's ability to collect electronic information. The NSA's chief had lobbied strongly against the proposed measure. The votes on an unusual coalition of conservative and liberal Democrats joined forces against the program, and the details of the NSA dragnet were made public, as you well know, by Edward Snowden, a former contractor for America's Electronic Spying Agency, who is now a fugitive seeking asylum in Moscow. So that's the story of what's happening there. Okay. And then we've got some other stories here. And this is really quite interesting. Also, a little bit beyond our normal scope of interest with regard to the Middle East, but this time it comes out of China. China Zhou Xilai, disgraced politician, is charged. So China has charged disgraced politician Zhou Xilai with bribery, corruption, abuse of power. That's what state media has said. So Zhou Xilai, formerly the Communist Party chief of Chongqing, was expelled from the party after a scandal surrounding the murder of a British businessman. Now, his wife, Gu Gailai, was jailed in August for the killing of a Briton, and the British guy's name was Neil Haywood. So Mr. Bo was charged by prosecutors on Thursday in Jinan in Shandong province, the state media had said. The Bo Xilai scandal, which exposed corruption claims and infighting at the top of the Communist Party, was one of the biggest to rock China in years. And Mr. Bo had taken advantage of his office to accept an extremely large amount of money and properties, state-run news agency Xinhua said, citing the indictment papers. He is also charged with embezzling public funds, so said Xinhua, the news agency. And the sending of the formal indictment report in the city of Jinan suggests the trial is now imminent. And however, no trial date has yet been announced, so that's really very interesting. So we'll find out a little bit more of what's going on there. And this is really quite fascinating because I didn't realize that things had changed in Spain, but evidently they did. As Spain's jobless rate falls for the first time in 2 years, Spain's unemployment rate has fallen for the first time in 2 years, according to official figures. The rate stood at 26.3% in the second quarter for the year, down from a record 27.2% in the first quarter. It seems a strong tourist season was credited with boosting employment, and tourism accounts for about 10% of the Spanish gross domestic product. So the news came a day after the Spanish Central Bank forecast that the economy will return to growth before the end of the year. It estimated the economy shrank again in the last quarter, but by only 0.1%. So Spain has been hit by a double recession since the collapse of the property market during the financial crisis in 2008. And the Spanish government of Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy says it also expects the recession to end soon. So very, very intriguing set of circumstances. We'll see what ends up happening here. It really will be very interesting to see where all that goes. Let's just go back to, one second, going back to the Middle East to see what else is happening. So, yes, that report from UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said that more than 100,000 people were killed in the Syrian conflict so far, and that just came out from the United Nations. Interestingly as well, we heard last night that the United States will delay the delivery of F-16 jets. Four of them were to be delivered. The excuse or the rationale behind the delay is the United States believing that there's too much unrest in Egypt at the moment, and this naturally following the army's overthrow of Mohamed Morsi as its president. So Pentagon spokesman George Little said the decision was made, quote, given the current situation in Egypt, end quote. The U.S. is examining whether Mr. Morsi's removal was a coup, which would trigger a legal requirement to cut off aid. Now, earlier, Egypt's army chief called for protests to give the military a mandate to confront potential terrorism. But Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said he was not calling for public unrest, and he urged national reconciliation. In response, the Muslim Brotherhood, which backs Mr. Morsi, said General Sisi was, quote, calling for civil war, end quote. And then, as recently as the 11th of July, the U.S. officials suggested the latest four F-16s would still be sent to Egypt. So evidently a change of plans as far as the United States is concerned, and it's a big issue. Well, you know, there's constant speculation one way or the other, and, you know, that always seems to be the case, no matter how we look at things. And, well, this is an interesting analysis by the BBC security correspondent by the name of Frank Gardner. He asked the question, is Egypt heading for a holy war? And he writes on and starts off in his first paragraph, which is really a sentence. He says, even posing that question will annoy many. Away from the trouble spots, life for millions of Egyptians continues as normal. Egypt's most fundamental problems are more economic than political. But in a week when the political arm of the Muslim Brotherhood called for an uprising by the great people of Egypt against those trying to steal their revolution with tanks, when dozens were killed in clashes between the army and Islamists, and when the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar warned of a civil war, an awkward question hovers in the air. Is Egypt now prone to a new holy war fought by Islamists against the authorities? There are plenty of grounds for optimism in the Arab world. In the Arab world's most populous country, should be able to avoid a descent into wide-scale, fanatical, religiously inspired violence following the ousting of President Mohamed Morsi last week. So having lived there twice for several years, I have experienced firsthand how good-natured, generous, and mostly tolerant Egyptians can be. There are extremists in their midst, but they are in a minority. Their views, however noisily they are broadcast, do not represent the bulk of the population. Egypt has also survived worse crises within living memory, the assassination of its president by a jihadist cell in 1981, and an Islamist insurgency that killed more than 700 people in the late 1990s, culminating in the massacre of 58 foreign tourists in Luxor in 1997. But given the unhappy confluence of events and trends surfacing in Egypt this week, it would be unwise to ignore the seeds of a potential holy war now being sown. Let's look at the ingredients. We will carry out explosions, we will shoulder arms, and nothing other than death will dissuade us from restoring President Morsi to the palace. The newspaper Al-Hayat quotes a bearded man proclaiming at one of the sit-ins by Muslim Brotherhood supporters. Now, small numbers of young men are starting to be seen in the crowd wearing the white shroud of martyrdom, a theatrical show of how far some say they are prepared to go to return an elected Islamist president to power. Since Mr. Morsi's removal, some internal forums have erupted with angry calls for vengeance against Egypt's military, calling it the enemy of Islam and declaring police and soldiers to be targets for attack, as they were in southern Egypt during the insurgency of the 1990s. For now, these statements are mostly rhetorical and aspirational, although security forces have often been attacked in the Sinai. The threat to mainland Egypt only becomes real when such rhetoric inspires people to translate it into violent action. Security in Egypt has deteriorated drastically since the overthrow of the dictatorial president Hosni Mubarak in 2011, but compared with Syria, Libya, Iraq, and Yemen, there are still relatively few firearms in private hands. Yet mainland Egypt is sandwiched between two land masses awash with illegal weapons, Libya and the Sinai Peninsula. The overthrow of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's regime next door in Libya threw open the doors to his armories, releasing a flood of firearms, many of which have ended up with jihadist groups operating across the Sahara in the eastern part of Libya. A UN report published in April concluded that, quote, weapons used during the Libyan civil war against Muammar Gaddafi are being funneled at an alarming rate to other countries in the region, end quote. It said the weapons range from small arms to high-powered explosives, mines, and portable air defense systems. The report said this flow of weapons into Egypt was a threat to its internal security because many were reaching anti-government insurgents in Sinai. Nearly 10% of Egypt's population are Coptic Christians. Mostly they live harmoniously in this Muslim-majority country, but some Islamist extremists want to see them driven out as much of Iraq's Christian population has been. There have been isolated but deadly attacks on Egypt's churches and Christians, and for the past year during Mr. Morsi's presidency, many Egyptian Copts doubted his government's commitment to protect their community properly. Now that he has been ousted, there is a counter-suspicion by some Muslim Brotherhood supporters that Christians somehow had a hand in his removal. If Egypt were to fall prey to jihadist violence, then its Coptic Christians would find themselves easy targets. There is an almost unanimous view amongst analysts of the Middle East that however incompetent the rule of President Morsi was, his forced removal after just 1 year in office sends a very dangerous message to Islamists. It risks leaving them with the conclusion that the democratic process the West has touted for so long is an avenue closed to them, prompting some to turn to the bullet instead of the ballot. Writing in Al-Quds Al-Arabi, the editor Abdel Bari Atwan said that the military coup will certainly lead to serving extremist groups within the Islamic current, specifically within the Muslim Brotherhood, and will confirm the argument of Al-Qaeda and other groups which reject democracy and consider it a Western invention. Lastly, but no less importantly, Egypt is facing a slow-motion economic crisis. Since the 2011 uprising against Mr. Mubarak, the country's latent economic and fiscal problems have gone into freefall. Tourism has slumped, unemployment and crime has soared, confidence has evaporated, and the government is running out of money. Mr. Morsi's inability to fix these problems was a major contributor to his unpopularity, but those problems will still be there for whoever becomes his elected successor. A combination of a falling economy, zero job prospects, and profound political frustration can lead to a dangerous sense of despair. Fertile ground, then, for those looking to recruit for nefarious purposes. And that's written by Frank R. Gardner, the security expert, correspondent from the BBC. So just fascinating turn of events there. Let's just look and see what else we have here. Actually, I'm going to play for you what's going on at the Westchester Broadway Theater, and then we'll be right back. So listen in.
The summer excitement is back at the Westchester Broadway Theater with our sizzling Saturday Night Special Series all through August, beginning on Saturday, August 10th, with the incredible Frankie Valli tribute, Let's Hang On. All the greatest hits of the four seasons like Sherry, Walk Like a Man, Big Girls Don't Cry, and so many more. Then on Saturday, August 17th, international singing and recording star Michael Amante returns with his amazing repertoire of romantic, classical, and Broadway hits. Then there's another great oldies and doo-wop night on the 24th with a double bill performance by the Teenagers and the Capris. And we'll finish the series with an hilarious adults-only Battle of the Sexes comedy night on Saturday, August 31st. And don't forget, before each of these great shows, you'll enjoy a delicious served dinner with a choice of six entrees. Order tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222. That's 914-592-2222. Come enjoy the summer weekends you've been waiting for with our Saturday Night Special Series all through August and only at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Welcome back. It seems that there is footage of closed caption footage which shows the horrific Galicia train crash in Spain. So shocking, literally shocking closed caption TV footage of Wednesday's devastating train accident in Spain emerged on Thursday amid reports that the train was traveling more than twice as fast as it should have been. At least 78 people were killed and some 140 injured in the crash. So it seems that a security camera stationed on the railway line into the Spanish city of Santiago de Compostela was captured or has captured the moment a passenger train carrying 218 people derailed, pushing all eight carriages off course and killing at least 78 people. And the dramatic footage was captured by a security camera stationed ahead of the site of the crash. Unbelievable. So the train was headed for the coastal city of Ferrol, derailed at 8:42 p.m. on a sharp curve some 4 kilometers from the city of Santiago de Compostela. An initial report showed that the train was traveling at 190 kilometers an hour, more than twice as fast as it should have been. So 190 kilometers an hour, that's about 120 miles to the hour. Woo. Wow. Now, the video has not been verified by Spanish authorities, but it was published on the website of the daily newspaper El País. So let's just see if we can play it for you. I don't know if there's any volume, but okay, you can see the train coming in. All of a sudden, it looked like there was an explosion. Let me repeat that. Let's just see. The seat coming in, just coming at the curve, boom, all of a sudden, well, you know what? It seems like it's an explosion, but that may be because the front carriage had already derailed. And the front carriage, the rear of the front carriage seems to have derailed. And upon its derailment, it seemed to create, in a sense, an explosion or a flash. Let me go look at it again. There it is. It looks like it may not even been fire. You know, this is a small video, but whatever the case is, let's just see one more time. Now I see what I saw. Isn't that ridiculous? And now I see what I saw, but that's important. Initially, there's a dust that is blown up into a cloud by the rear end of what seems to be the front carriage. And I saw the fire towards the back of the train, it's on the back left side of the train, where after the cloud of dust gets blown into the air, you see fire. So maybe at that point the heat was of such intensity that it caused something to become a blaze. But definitely, it just does not seem as though there was first an explosion, but rather an after effect of the train being derailed. Oh, I looked at it again. It might have not even been the first train. The front carriage, but maybe between the two of them, the front carriage and the back carriage, and maybe that's where it went crazy upon the derailment. There it is. Yeah, I can see it even before it quite hits the intensity of the full turn. It seems to have derailed. Unbelievable footage. Go figure. Go figure. Oh my God! And the intensity of all these people. My God, that have literally died, and the people who are hurt. Oh, just amazing. Oh, for God's sake. Anyway, very, very bad news. All right, let's go back to the Middle East. And it seems that Turkey has fallen to 154th place in the World Press Freedom Index. Isn't that interesting? So it seems that Turkey has fallen in the ranks of Reporters Without Borders' annual World Press Freedom Index, dropping to 154th on the list. The Paris-based group also noted that Turkey currently imprisons more journalists than any other country in the world. So Turkey has fallen down the ranks of the Reporters Without Borders' World Press Freedom Index, dropping to the 154th on the list. And Reporters Without Borders stated that Turkey, a country of political importance amid the Syrian conflict, was currently the world's biggest prison for journalists, and the country plummeted from 148th to 154th on this year's list. Unbelievable. So the report also targeted Turkey for failing to live up to its aspirations of being a regional model, quote, despite a varied and lively media presence in the country. And the Turkish state was criticized for exhibiting paranoia without security, which has a tendency to see more criticism as a plot hatched by a variety of illegal organizations. So the paranoia has intensified during the past year, which was marked by rising tension over the Kurdish question, so the media advocacy group had said. So Syria, meanwhile, has become the deadliest country for journalists, as reporters suffered both from civil war and from government's attempts to crack down on media coverage. And this is the report from Hürriyet Daily News, the Turkish publication. Wow, so unbelievable circumstances. Let's head back to other issues in the Middle East. And in Iraq, it seems that the Iraqi government are hunting the escaped militants after the Al-Qaeda prison raids. Some 500 militants were among the prisoners three then simultaneous attacks on two Iraqi prisons, al-Qaeda said on Tuesday. The raids come as Iraq experiences a fresh wave of violence that many fear could push the country to the brink of civil war. So al-Qaeda on Tuesday claimed responsibility for two simultaneous raids on Iraqi prisons on the outskirts of Baghdad, in which it said 500 Islamist militants were set free. The attacks on the Taji and Abu Ghraib prisons, which began late on Sunday night and carried on into Monday, are among the most brazen assaults to have been carried out by al-Qaeda in Iraq and have sparked an extensive hunt for escapees by the authorities. At least 25 members of the security forces, along with 21 prisoners and 8 and 10 militants, were killed in the attacks, according to Iraqi officials. So that's the situation that's occurred there. And again, a frightening set of circumstances. Let's just see what else is happening. You know, let's go over to Latin America, see what's going on. Let's see. This is going to be very interesting because Pope Francis, one second. Yeah, here it is. Pope Francis is going to visit one of the favelas in Rio. Yep. Pope Francis requested a favela or shantytown be included in his schedule of visits. Seems Pope Francis is due to visit a poor neighborhood of the Brazilian city of Rio de Janeiro, and the Pope will address residents of the community of Valhinha in the latest stop of his visit to Brazil, the first foreign trip of his papacy. On Wednesday, he visited a Rio clinic for drug addicts, where he criticized drug legislation plans. On the fourth day of his visit to Brazil, he will also greet the faithful at the World Youth Day in Copacabana. And Varinha is a part of the larger Vinhos Favela, one of the many hillside shanty towns which surround Rio. And once a byword for poverty, crime, and drugs, the Brazilian government has made the pacification of these communities one of its priorities. Heavily armed police have moved into some of the more lawless favelas, including Varinha, to flush out, quote, the criminals and drug dealers who control large swathes of these communities. And according to official estimates, more than 20% of the population of the city live in favelas. Now, the Pope, who has called for a Church of the Poor, and who during his time as Archbishop of Buenos Aires in Argentina, regularly visited some of the poorest areas of that city, specifically asked for a favela to be included in his schedule. He's expected to meet a family and bless a small local church before addressing residents gathered at a football field. Locals say the government's policy of sending large numbers of police to the area has gone some way towards calming the area, but not enough. There is no state presence. Our community was forgotten for a long time. I hope with the Pope's visit we can have some improvement, Carpenter Paulo Lima told NBC News. So the visit comes just a day after Pope Francis said it was key to tackle the roots of drug abuse rather than consider legalizing them. At a mass at the shrine of Aparecida, he also warned tens of thousands of faithful against the passing idols, quote-unquote, of money, power, and pleasure. How many dealers of death there are that follow the logic of power and money at any cost, he told the congregation. The scourge of drug trafficking that favors violence and sows the seeds of suffering and death requires of society as a whole an act of courage. Leaders in Colombia, Bolivia, Ecuador, and others have spoken for softer stances on drug policy in Uruguay. A project decriminalizing marijuana sale is set to be voted in Congress next week. The highlight of the Pope's trip to Brazil is expected to be a prayer service on Rio's Copacabana Beach later on Thursday, which is likely to draw hundreds of thousands of people. So, definitely all eyes are literally on the Pope in his trip to Rio de Janeiro. Unbelievable. You know, from the very moment he was chosen, it just seems that this is the man of the moment, and his legacy will be great because he invigorates the rationale, you know, for, you know, for reaching out to a God that's understood by many people. And it's just that he connects. You know, he connects no matter the economic situation of the people to whom he speaks. A very, very unique individual. I guess we're all lucky. At least I can. I find it, just an honor to be in his presence, even though he's like millions of miles away. So just very, very fascinating. Most, most sincerely. Well, this is also really quite interesting. As long as we're in South America, we might as well find out what's happening in Bolivia. So it seems that the Bolivian leader, Evo Morales, has accepted the apologies over a plane row. So it seems that Bolivian President Evo Morales says he accepts the apologies from European countries, which barred his jet from flying onto or into their airspace last month. The Bolivians accused France, Spain, Portugal, and Italy on an alleged U.S. tip-off that the fugitive intelligence analyst Edward Snowden was on board a plane flying from Moscow. The Europeans apologized and said the decision had been due to mistakes. Mr. Snowden has been in the transit area of the Moscow airport since June 23rd. Now, Mr. Morales said he was not fully satisfied with the apologies, but accepted them nevertheless. Because we want to continue relationships of respect among our countries, relationships which are complementary and in solidarity with consequence, and in coordination with our ministries and the presidents, we have agreed to send our ambassadors back, he told reporters, at the Bolivian capital of La Paz. After his flight diversion, Bolivia had recalled their ambassadors to the involved countries. I remember being in Bolivia, in La Paz, and just a beautiful country. Just an absolutely beautiful country. So unique, so unique. I remember crossing over from Puno in the southern tip of Peru, along the Lake Titicaca, and from there, moving to a place called, let me remember the name, Tihuanaco, that's what it is. The place was called Tihuanaco. I went there maybe 30 years ago, and at that time, Tihuanaco was a settlement, or maybe just simply it was unsure because it wasn't completely unearthed, or a in a sense like not a church, not a Christian church or Jewish synagogue or a mosque, but in a sense, it was a place of religiosity because it was the place that focused in on the sun. And so Tihuanaco was the name of the place, and it was just being unearthed, and it was just being discovered at that time. And then the trip on to La Paz. Absolutely beautiful, beautiful, beautiful country, my God. Well, the joke is, depending on what side of the border you're on, if you're in Bolivia, you claim the titty part of the Titicaca Lake. And if you're on the Peruvian side, you claim the same titty part of the Titicaca Lake. So, you know, so it seems that they leave the caca for the other side. But whatever the case is, it's an absolutely beautiful, beautiful lake. And the importance of the lake itself is probably underwater, where when you go underneath, you can actually find, I guess, historic sites, temples that are there. And it's just an absolute amazing sort of thing. And what's also fascinating, too, is that reeds border the perimeter of the lake. And those are the same type of reeds that they were able to put together into creating like a reed boat in by tying the two ends of the straw, very, very long, tall straw strips. And they, once they were dried, they somehow were able to put it together, tie the ends off, and they could actually make you know, long trips in the Pacific. It was amazing. But that used to be in other places as well. So very, very interesting. And this is a very important story. I think that Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, he has accepted the apologies over the stalling of his plane being permitted to travel beyond, because he had gotten, or rather, the countries that wanted to stop him from continuing his flight refused to give him flight authorization over their country, such as France and Spain and Portugal and Italy, caused his delay. But it seems that Mr. Snowden, the reason they were didn't want the Bolivian president to continue in his travel was not on board. So big blunder, that's for sure. Okay, well, it's about a quarter to the hour. Let's find out what else is happening at the Westchester Broadway Theater. So listen in if you would.
It's one of the most celebrated musicals of all time, with an unforgettable score by the world's most famous songwriting team. And it's on stage now at the Westchester Broadway Theater through August the 11th. Rodgers and Hammerstein's incomparable The Sound of Music. It's the classic story of Maria, the young governess who brings her love of music to the Von Trapp family amidst the intrigue of pre-war Europe. This uplifting story is the perfect musical for the entire family this summer, and its irresistible score includes some of Broadway's most memorable hits like My Favorite Things, Edelweiss, Do Re Mi, Climb Every Mountain, and many more. And remember, before the show, you and your family will enjoy a delicious served dinner with a choice of six entrees with special prices for the kids. Order tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222. That's 914-592-2222. Now's the time to rediscover Broadway right in your own backyard. This summer, bring the entire family to experience one of the world's best-loved musicals, Rodgers and Hammerstein's The Sound of Music, now through August the 11th, only at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Well, we're going to come back to the United States for news. This is Westchester on the Level. My name is Jesse Harris, and we'll continue, this time focusing on Bradley Manning. The closing arguments are beginning in that case. So closing arguments have begun in the trial of the U.S. soldier who disclosed hundreds of thousands of secret documents to the website WikiLeaks. Private First Class Bradley Manning has already pleaded guilty to 10 of the more than 20 counts he faces. Last week, a military judge refused to dismiss the most serious charge against him, aiding the enemy, for which he could serve life in prison. The case is considered the largest ever leak of secret U.S. government documents. Analysts say the verdict to be decided by a judge alone could have a big impact on future leakers. Private Manning, 25, has not denied his role in the leak, but in February said at a pre-trial hearing he had disclosed the documents to spark a public debate about U.S. military and foreign policy. His defense lawyer, David Coombs, argued there was no proof he aided the enemy. Mr. Coombs claimed he was guilty of negligence but acted without the general evil intent required to justify the life charge. Mr. Coombs has argued the former intelligence analyst was, quote, young, naive, and good-intentioned, end quote, when he arrived in Iraq in 2009, but soon became disillusioned. Military prosecutors maintained the leak damaged national security and endangered American lives and those of foreign intelligence and diplomatic sources, and said Private Manning used his military training and access to gain notoriety. To obtain a conviction on the charge of aiding the enemy, prosecutors must prove Private Manning acted with intent to aid the enemy and knowingly gave such adversaries U.S. intelligence information. They have argued Private Manning had systematically harvested documents, adding the accused must have known al-Qaeda operatives would see the leaked documents once they were made available online. Judge Colonel Denise Lind last week declined to dismiss the aiding the enemy charge, ruling Private Manning's training as an intelligence analyst showed he would have known about military or militant organizations' use of the Internet. But it is still possible that Private Manning will be acquitted of that charge. Among the items sent to WikiLeaks was a graphic footage of an Apache helicopter attack in 2007 that killed a dozen people in the Iraqi capital of Baghdad, including a Reuters photographer. Other files leaked included thousands of battlefield reports from Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as secure messages between U.S. embassies and the U.S. and the United States State Department in Washington. So Private Manning was arrested in May of 2010 while serving in Iraq. He spent weeks in a cell at Camp Arifyan, a U.S. Army installation in Kuwait, and he was then transferred to the maximum security prison at Guantanamo in Virginia, where he was locked up alone for 23 hours a day in a small cell for nearly 9 months and had to sleep naked for several nights. Whatever prison sentence Private Manning receives will be reduced by 112 days after a judge ruled he had suffered unduly harsh treatment during his initial detention following his arrest. Wow, isn't that amazing? Just totally amazing. Okay, let's go back to the prior page. And okay. Oh, I don't know if you learned about this yet, but I guess you've heard about it. And this is about the royal baby. Why George Alexander Louis? It's a good question. So the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge's first baby has been named George Alexander Louis. But what's in the name? It is a partial victory for the old maxim, the bookmakers are never wrong. George was the solid rock favorite for the boys' names for a while, backed all the way down to January 2nd. Alexander and Louis were both not far behind. A cynic might point out that before we knew it was a boy, Alexander, the Queen's first middle name, had been the favorite. Of the three names, it is the significance of the third that is most obvious. Louis immediately makes one think of Louis Mountbatten, uncle of Prince Philip and last Viceroy of India, who was killed by the IRA in a bomb attack on his yacht. Now, his father, Prince Louis of Battenberg, was Prince William's great-great-grandfather. Louis is also one of William's middle names, and of course the name of 17 kings of France, or 18 or 19, depending on how you count. So if Louis honors one side of the royal family, George clearly resonates with the other. Despite St. George being a patron saint of England, it took the arrival of a German king, George I, to cement the name's place in England. Long a popular name in Germany, it has Greek roots. There have since been five other Georges to sit on the throne. George III, king during the loss of the American colonies, is perhaps now best known for his mental illness thanks to Alan Bennett's play and the subsequent film adaptation. His son George was a figure who certainly attracted more than his share of criticism. Arguably, the best known portrayal of him was by Hugh Laurie in the third series of Blackadder. In that comedy, he is a drunken, philandering fool, spectacularly limited grace and intelligence. Now, the real George was certainly both a drinker and womanizer who ate too much. Times labeled him an inveterate voluptuary, but also an imaginative town planner, an ambitious patron of the arts, and most probably not an idiot. The most recent Georges reigned through two world wars. It was George V who declared war on Germany in 1914, pitting him against his first cousin, Kaiser Wilhelm II. Now, George V recognized the strength of anti-German feeling and changed the royal family's name from the House of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha to the more English-sounding Windsor. It was his son, George VI, whose struggles with his stutter are so movingly depicted in the King's Speech, christened Albert and known to his family as Bertie, but crowned as George, he's a reminder that the monarch has the final say on their regnal name. On the other hand, Alexander has never been the name of a king of England or the United Kingdom, but was born by three kings of Scotland. And yet, for any parent naming their child Alexander, it must be hard not to hear the phrase "the great" sotto voce immediately afterwards. And Alexander's famously conquered much of the known world and is often described as the best general ever to live. But he was not a well-rounded individual, an epic binge drinker who once killed a friend with a spear in a drunken rage. He only made it to the age of 32 before either ill health or well-disguised murder did for him. The two later rulers of Macedon called Alexander, one of them his son, were both murdered, but that has not stopped the name being popular with rulers down the ages. Perhaps the least successful, Alexander was the sole Byzantine emperor to bear that name. Of him, historian Viscount Norwich said, "The only good thing that can be said of the reign of the Emperor Alexander is that it was mercifully short." Now, this Alexander supposedly died after an ill-advised game of polo in very hot weather, and modern Alexanders might want to heed this example. So, isn't that interesting? Oh, there's always something to learn. That's what life is all about. This is like so, so exciting. I mean, to me it is. I don't know about you. I hope it excites you as well. And let's just see if anything else is happening here in the United States that we weren't aware about. Oh, I don't know if you heard about this. Caroline Kennedy. You remember her? Caroline Kennedy is nominated for ambassador to Japan. Hold on a minute while I take a sip of water. President Barack Obama has nominated Caroline Kennedy, the daughter of former President John F. Kennedy, to be America's ambassador to Japan. Ms. Kennedy, a lawyer by training, was a key Obama supporter in 2008 and 2012, but has largely shunned political life. If confirmed by the Senate, she would be the first woman to serve as envoy to Japan, a crucial U.S. ally in Asia. She's the only surviving child of the assassinated president and former First Lady Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy. The White House announced the nomination with little fanfare, listing Ms. Kennedy in a roll call of selections for various administration posts. Mr. Obama said in a statement that the choices brought a depth of experience and tremendous dedication to their new roles, but he offered no comment specific to Miss Kennedy. Meanwhile, the chairman of the Kennedy Library Foundation, where Ms. Kennedy serves as president, congratulated her in a statement saying, quote, "I can think of no one better to represent this country with strength and integrity," end quote. The post would be the highest profile public role for Ms. Kennedy. The 55-year-old has served at many nonprofit organizations and has been active in supporting Democratic politicians. She is considered running for a New York State Senate seat when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State in 2009, but declined citing personal reasons. Ms. Kennedy supported Mr. Obama early in his 2008 presidential run, the only time she endorsed a presidential candidate other than her uncle, Ted Kennedy, in 1980. Japan is among Japan's largest trading partners, and previous U.S. ambassadors to Tokyo have included former Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, former Vice President Walter Mondale, and former House Speaker Tom Foley. If confirmed, Ms. Kennedy will replace John Roos, a wealthy former Silicon Valley lawyer and top Obama campaign fundraiser. So I didn't know. I don't know if you knew about that. I just don't know. Oh, and this is something way off the deep end. Certainly not Middle East in flavor. But it turns out the cat allergy research offers new clues. Scientists have discovered how allergic reactions to cats are triggered, raising hopes of preventative medicine. A University of Cambridge team in England has identified how the body's immune system detects cat allergen, leading to symptoms such as coughing and sneezing. New treatments to block this pathway raise hopes of developing medicines to protect sufferers, they say. Allergy UK says the research is a big step forward in understanding how cat allergen causes allergic reactions. Researchers led by Dr. Claire Bryant of the University of Cambridge studied proteins found in particles of skin of cat skin known as cat dander, which is the most common cause of cat allergy. They found that cat allergen activates a special pathway in the body once in the presence of a common bacterial toxin. This triggers a large immune response in allergy sufferers, causing symptoms such as coughing, sneezing, wheezing, and a runny nose. And Dr. Bryan told BBC News, quote, "We've discovered how the cat allergy proteins activate the host immune cells. By understanding the triggering mechanism, there are now drugs that have been designed that are in clinical trials for other conditions such as sepsis that could potentially then be used in a different way to treat cat allergy and prevent cat allergy. So the charity Allergy UK said the research published in Journal of Immunology was a big step forward in understanding how cat allergen causes such a severe allergic reactions. Cat allergen is particularly difficult to avoid as it is a sticky molecule that is carried into every building on people's shoes and clothes, said Director of Clinical Services Maureen Jenkins. It can also be found in a home, on the walls and ceilings or fittings, even a few years after a cat has ceased to live there. Therefore, this new information identifying the specific receptor interaction in the immune system could pave the way for treatments for those with persistent disease triggered by cat allergen and in the future potentially dog and house dust mite allergen. So allergic reactions happen when the immune system reacts to a personal, to a perceived danger. Instead of responding to a harmful bacteria or virus, it misidentifies allergens such as cat dander and mounts an immune response. The research was founded by the Wellcome Trust and the Medical Research Council. Very, very fascinating and interesting study, to say the least. All right, well, I think we're at the end of the day for us here. I have a special evening event tonight, which will consume a tremendous amount of time, and yet at the same time, I also need to complete some projects for the paper tonight. So I hope you'll join us tomorrow. We'll be speaking to some fascinating people who will talk to us about rape, specifically in the military, and we're going to recognize for the first time, which for most people, or most people will be totally unaware, is that men outnumber women when it comes to being violated in the military. A lot of that has to do with the fact that men happen to be the preponderance population of people engaged in the military. So percentage-wise, women may be more often violated in percentage ratios, but men, because there are more men in the military than women, the number of people violated is greater. So even though the percentages may be lower overall. And we're going to talk about this new film that was put together about this issue. We're going to talk to people who have suffered being violated, what they've done to cope with the process and to explore this whole issue in the American military. So we've got a lot to learn. I hope you'll tune in tomorrow and learn a great deal more about it. So until then, I wish you a good day and be safe. And I guess that's about it. So thank you very much for joining us. It's really been a total pleasure. Goodbye.